On today's show, we discuss the eternal battle of good versus evil in the context of five-a-side football.
Representing good, Luke Skywalker, Indiana Jones, Greta Thunberg, Nelson Mandela, captained by Chase from the Paw Patrol.
And representing evil, we have Hitler, Nidge from Love Hate, Skeletor, Oliver Cromwell, captained by Lance Armstrong, with Tom Cruise on the bench. We'll also be discussing rugby!
The World Cup final, England versus South Africa.
Joe presents Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello and you're very welcome to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Nothing Irish to shout about this weekend, but there was the battle, the age-long battle of good and evil this weekend. Representing evil in the red corner
were Springboks.
The Springboks and Wales. Representing good were England and New Zealand. Two very different games. You didn't need to be an Irish supporter to enjoy those, I think. No. That doesn't make sense. We were Irish supporters, but we weren't supporting Ireland. But I think we still enjoyed the England game. Flip me, the South Africa game was terrible,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was literally like, I think the Japanese were the real good guys, but they were almost like, you know, when there's a war movie and there's like, don't take this personally. There's always like one super religious guy who's really, really, really keen and really pure, and he always gets killed in the middle of the, you know, like in the middle of the movie. You know, uh-huh. He's gonna die. That was Japan. They were like the brave heroes moving on, and then they come up against the power of, I'm not gonna call the Springboks the Nazis, but World War II is probably the closest.
You're
thing
not
I have.
Going to call them Nazis,
no.
But you're going to suggest that might be the conclusion that people jump to.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. And
so I'm still offended because you said don't take this personally.
But that's a disclaimer. Once I say that, you can't take it personally.
In the history of conversations,
yeah.
Who has ever been preempted with "don't take this personally" and not took whatever came next personally?
Don't take this personally, you bell end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It could have been worse. It could have been a lot worse.
But it was like when Japan got knocked out, they were the real purists, like just playing this beautiful rugby. Didn't really have any kicking game. They're just looking to run the ball, be expansive all the time. And they came up against South Africa, and it was like the law of the jungle. It was just like might overcame expansive rugby.
Yeah.
And then you kind of had, I'm not really sure where Wales, maybe Italy? They were the Italians, if you have the World War II analogy
you're still going
again.
Okay.
And you have Germany and you have the Italians coming together. But it was like, it was pretty stark contrast to the game on Saturday.
Yeah.
Very different styles of rugby.
Felt like South Africa, quarterfinals we're talking about here against Japan, just went, enough of that. We're not going to be pushing the game any further in Japan. It's gone far enough here. No more creativity.
Yeah.
Don't be making this game any more attractive than is suitable for us. And then Dwayne Vermeulen gets the ball against Wales. I think that carry, was it off a restart? Or he bashed the
Thomas
the,
Francis, yeah.
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 Yeah. That was South African rugby, like in a nutshell.
Yeah, we were playing to their strengths. It was actually when we were... Tommy Bowe was saying that when we were watching it inside in the studio, he just said, I used to hate that when the ball would be kicked off and the number eight would catch it with enough time and you'd see him scanning the line. And Tommy said he'd be running going, oh,
yeah, I know.
Loads of space over here. Yeah. Loads of space. I'll just connect him. Yeah. Connect. And just running straight at him then. And oh man, he
How did the Francis. Tight head, how did the tight head get, how did Francis get there first? Actually, right now, surely George North should have been taking one for the team there.
I don't know. It was, if you carry infield, you generally have your prop slightly more infield. So
yeah.
The number eight.
It was too far away.
The number eight catches it, he's going to, the more infield he can get, if he can get to the 15, it gives you a great angle to get on the kick as opposed to carrying straight. And you're generally going to have your front row forwards in closer to the middle of the field. So when he carried in, it's just painful for him.
Yeah. Quite often I've found as you're chasing as a winger there, sometimes if the eight carries and kind of goes sideways, you can get fortunate. And it can be a slightly more convenient side-on tackle.
Yeah.
I think it's really stupid of Wales to keep kicking to Dwayne Vermeulen, though. Same thing. I was commentating on the Ulster game the weekend, and I made the point. Every restart, Jared Evans, the Cardiff 10, who out of that Ulster team do you not want to kick to? Marcel could see it three or four times, just straight to him, and let him charge back and get a gain line. I remember Gilroy saying about Franco van der Merwe. He'd walk into a room and Gilly would go, currently I am double XL. By the summer, I intend to be triple XL. It's like South African rugby. Get big, get physical, and yeah, smash fellas.
I had to think a lot of it, you know, because obviously we that's how we played with Munster, and we tried to add layers on it. And to be fair, I would not, like, you'd be pretty condescending to think that that's all that the Springbok coaches had.
Yeah,
that's all they have for now, because they came in barely 18 months out from the World Cup.
Yeah,
so they had to try and align all of South African rugby first, try and get it so that they can select all the players overseas, then get it so they can get access to the players that are currently playing in the Super Rugby franchises. As in, like,
there was a lot of politics to
the way we used to have mini camps all the time with Ireland. They wouldn't have that with the Box. So then for Jacques Minabre, the defence coach, to be able to go down to the Sharks and do like a session for an hour, that couldn't have happened in the past. So they're all things that they had to do within the 18 months, and then try and get the team, get the game plan put in situ, try and get everyone aligned, get everyone fit and conditioned, because you've got some guys who are playing in France, like they got Vermeulen back to South Africa to play with the Bulls. They got the players conditioned, but like, you know that, like, if what we saw against Wales, and to be fair, it's the same for Wales, if that's the level, if they don't go anywhere beyond that, they become so predictable that teams figure them out.
Mm-hmm.
So you start adding layers. So after we had it with Munster, that was our first year, and it's a really pragmatic way of rugby. It's super simple. You don't play any rugby in your half. If it's on, so if you catch the ball and you're like, oh, I've got a tight head prop in front of me and I'm inside of my own half, go. Absolutely go. You've got license to go. If you catch the ball in your half and it's not on, you're not going to score a try, then everyone else in the team knows Andrew's going to carry this ball back, we're going to resource the ruck, and then we're going to get to the kick, or we're going to have a look then and see. So we're going to either see if the box kick is on, we'll get to the box kick. If not, we might go back to 10 and go with a cross field.
Yeah.
If that's not on, we might move it and look to kick on the edge. You're always, the focus is always to get out of your own half.
Yeah.
Now, if you're moving it to the edge and the run is on, then you take the run. But if the run isn't on, then you get to the kick. You've got to give yourself the depth to get to the kick.
Yeah. It looked like at the weekend it was simplified even further. It looked like an even more simple version of the South African game plan. Maybe because they were playing against Wales, who they knew were going to be physical and they were going to kick as well. So I think it was just don't get bored first.
Yeah.
This is going to work for us if we keep going. But it looked like the game plan was this. In our half, kick it. In their half, give it to Colby. What do you mean Colby's not playing? Okay, in our half, kick it. In their half, kick it.
Yeah. It was, I think they put so much of a focus on their maul and their set piece, and they did get good returns from that. Like, I think if you look at it for their try, they had a scrum penalty. They got up, they had a maul. Then Malcolm Marks broke down the blind side for them all.
Uh-huh.
They played back in field. And then they had two injections then. That was the difference. Two injections. Pollard injected onto the ball, like actually hit the ball flat at pace, offloaded to Malcolm Marks. Malcolm Marks carried again. They got in behind him. And then Pollard came back against the grain, made a little breach. They got a penalty advantage. And then they moved the ball and they got Delenda scored.
That was ridiculous.
It was just brute strength.
Yeah.
But the difference was that... They had two injections from Pollard.
Yeah.
That was it. That's all they had in terms of creativity.
Yeah.
Everything else is maul, scrum.
I'm not bagging it at all, actually. I'm taking the piss, right? But genuinely, if you've got a pack that physical, why would you not play that sort of rugby?
Well, that's exactly...
I'm not slagging it.
It's because it's so one-sided. Like, most teams start off with that. Most teams start off and they'll say, let's get a really strong set piece. Let's get our small, strong line out. Let's get a strong scrum. Then we'll get our defence really, really strong. And then we'll have a really strong kicking game. And all of those things are pretty mechanical. Do you know what I mean? It's black and white. You know what I mean? You say you're either going to maul this way, and once you've agreed on it, you maul that way. Scrummaging, you're going to scrum a certain way. There's only, like, the laws doesn't give you a huge amount of leeway to how you're going to go. Defensively, you can be a line speed team, you can turf wedge, you can have systems, but you decide on that. And none of those are based on talent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you get to your kicking game. Kicking game is going to a little bit is going to, the strategy you can take around your kicking game is going to be dictated by the accuracy of your 9, 10, 15 or whoever is going to be your primary kickers. If they're really accurate, you might go after contestable balls if you've got, if they're really accurate and if you've got good guys who are good in the air.
Yeah.
If they're not accurate, then you might just say, okay, we're going to go for a little bit more territory and we're going to focus on a real strong kick chase and then pressuring them on once the opposition have received the ball. And then the last layer that you bring, generally add in, is your attack, because the attack is way more vague. It's like what you...
It's harder to tie down. It's harder to add on. It's
like everyone can have an opinion on attack. They can say, oh, well, this is what I felt we could have done here. This is what I felt we could have done there. Whereas in defence, because it's a system, you say, well, we agreed on the system, so this is what everyone should be doing when we watch a clip back. In attack, it's a little bit like when you're talking unstructured attack. All the other stuff is structured. That's the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and England, that's where England went.
That's what I was going to say. Because so, like, defensively, it looked like the way England performed, the way South Africa performed, are just so different. But by the large part, set piece is good. Their kicking game's good. They're physical. They front up. Their defense is just getting off the line. It's the most simple thing ever. But no one else does it anywhere near as well. And I think even England did it better than South Africa did it. Get off the line, literally. Run back there till you're onside, get into a three-point stance. When the nine delivers the ball, run as fast as you can that direction. Why are we so impressed with that? You know, because it's so difficult to get. I know I'm taking the piss here, right? Because I remember being in Ulster teams in the past. Johnny Bell hammered line speed for years. And it took us like a couple of seasons with him to finally get it. And then we're going, this is really effective. Why have we not done this further? What has who's England defence coach?
Mitchell.
What's he done? He wasn't Saracens, was he? No.
No, he was in. He was the Kiwi.
Oh, yeah.
He was in the Bulls.
What's he done like to and what's Razzy done? Like what
is Jacques, what's the emphasis? Jack is a defence. The difference is, man, is when people say line speed, this is just what I got.
Yeah,
from
fine.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I'm marking the ball carrier and they go line speed, I'm going to sprint at him. And everyone gets it. Now we're bringing line speed. But line speed is actually the whole team operating at the same on the same wavelength. In that, like, when I'm sprinting at him, the guy who's out in the wing is sprinting as well. Because if you think of it, when the first pass comes, you come up on the first pass.
Yeah.
And then on the second pass, you're getting up. You're reading. And then on the third pass, you close it off. So a team should never get three passes away against you. Yeah. Even if they're playing with depth. But the key is that if I put pressure on the first guy with line speed, the guy outside me has to be loaded, that if I actually force that guy to deliver an inaccurate pass or to pass it a little bit earlier than he wants, that we can capitalise on that by being up on the outside.
Yeah.
Most teams bring line speed on the inside, like coming up on the ball, but it's on the outside that's the problem. If you look at Tuilagi's intercept...
Sorry, when you say the outside, do you mean the wings, starting on the outside shoulder and going slightly in?
No, on the outside of the pitch.
Uh-huh.
As in like... If the ruck is in the middle of the feet, if the ruck is on the 15 and they're playing open side and you sprint at the first receiver, but the guys outside you aren't sprinting, you're bringing line speed on him and he's forced to give his pass earlier than he would have liked.
Uh-huh.
But then because the rest of the lads outside you haven't come up to sprint alongside you, it means that the opposition now have time to recover.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's a bad pass, we have time to recover. But if everyone comes up at the same time, it suffocates them and it shuts down their space. And when you're the first receiver for the opposition in attack, when you get the ball in your hands, there's a guy sprinting at you, and when you look to see if you can throw the pass, you'll see bodies out there and you'll go, oh shit, I can't throw that pass, and you end up ducking back inside.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing about it, is people are risk averse.
Yeah,
you know?
So it strikes me that defence in those situations you're talking about, or the type of the defence that was on display at the weekend by Springboks and England, and the other sides to a lesser extent as well, wasn't about being physical or making tackles. It's about getting in passing channels and outsmarting attackers and almost tricking attacks.
A little bit, yeah. You've just got to consistently keep getting up. But it's really tiring. And the key thing is to watch the ball all the time. Because I think New Zealand end up watching the man. So if you think of it, say you're a winger, okay? So say you have to do three defensive sets. So three defensive sets are... The opposition are going to attack, there's going to be a tackle. The opposition are going to attack, there's going to be a tackle. The opposition are going to attack, there's going to be a tackle. So that should be three shuttle runs forward for you.
Three longer shuttle runs.
Yeah, yeah. But you want
for
to think,
for the winger.
Yeah, for the wing because you're covering more distance. But the difference is that if you're watching the man, then what happens is that you sprint up and you're watching the guy opposite you. You're not aware of where the ball's going. That guy, if he starts to sprint open, he starts to manipulate you. You start reacting to him, even though he doesn't have the ball. Consequently, because you're not watching the ball, that there could be a tackle on the inside, but you don't react quick enough to get back to get set for the next one because you've been watching the man. If you're watching the ball, you come up on the first one. If there's a tackle occurred, you get straight back and you're ready to go again. Do you understand?
I do, and I know there was a big moment when Farrell came in to Irish rugby and changed the emphasis, and it was watch the ball, don't watch the man.
Yeah,
and it took a while to get used to. Even the theory, to me, I understand the benefits from it, but there's been times. I mean, it's an age old expression. He's ball watching, you know. And sometimes in defence, you might just be looking in slightly, and then you get done. Yeah. You don't realise how much this attacker has bounced outside, and you kind of miss the jump a little bit. There's an element of that isn't covered in that concept.
The difference when Jacques used to do it with us at Munster is that.
I didn't realise, sorry, he's the same, he's watched the ball.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Jacques would have been the first guy on everything defensively. Like he's been a defensive specialist for years before, like I'd say Sean Edwards is probably the first guy around really.
Yeah.
But the whole idea is that it's a zonal system. You're not concerned with what's in front of you so much. You're not trying to match up and mark up. It's more trying to fill as much of the field as you can. So there's a massive focus when you're a watch the ball line speed team on making sure you get your spacings. So, like, it's simple for us saying, okay, well, it's 3 metres, it's 1 metre from the ruck, it's 2 metres from the second defender, and it's 3 metres then for everyone on the way out. And you cover as much distance as you can. And then it's just getting up as hard as you can all the time. So you're filling as much of the field as you can. Whereas if you get a little bit tight, so you're not so concerned with, you know, in the past when we used to defend years ago with Ireland, they used to, like, ID, make sure you ID everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got him. And you've got him, but then if my guy runs across, do I follow him?
Uh-huh.
He's manipulated me already, even though he doesn't have the ball.
Yeah.
So the idea is that it's just you're marking space.
Yeah.
So you try and fill as much of the field as you can,
mm-hmm.
and then you just make sure you get up. And if you fill as much of the field as you can, the opposition shouldn't be able to get 3 passes away.
So this is Farrell's rationale for that. Just he says you create your own spacing, regardless of what they're doing. Because he said, no matter what they're doing, they're only trying to deceive you anyway.
Yeah.
They're only lying to you anyway. But there's an element of that is true, right? So they might be starting in one position, they might end up in another position, but they're not lying because he is is there. Like, I can see him. Like, there's only so much lying he can do. So I think there's an element. I actually had to fully bought into it. But I could appreciate there were elements of the old system that maybe weren't captured in it as well. But anyway, listen.
You made a lot of good shots in D with Ireland.
I started to enjoy the system and enjoy the thing that I liked was getting whenever we didn't always get it, getting either 9 or 10 pushing the fullback to make sure he closed the gate a little bit more, which freed the winger up to make reads, which I think is so valuable. And you can see it with South Africa. Both their wingers make reads and they get it wrong occasionally, but they're so fast that they can often recover because it's a loopy pass.
But even if you do make a read and you don't, if you go to make a read and you don't execute the tackle, you'll still generally have disrupted the attack pattern. And if your line speed is enough that you get 15 metres past the gain line when you make that, or 10 metres past the gain line, well, then you've got 10 more metres to recover back to,
to soak. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, if you look at it, like, I looked at some of the stats, like, England against New Zealand, England missed 34 tackles, New Zealand missed 20. But England were missing their tackles so far up the field.
Yeah.
And that's generally what you'll see with all line speed teams.
Say it again, England missed how many?
England had 34 missed tackles and New Zealand had 20 missed tackles.
Yeah. So something similar happened. I was talking about this recently, about how data can be misleading at times. The first game of the Six Nations, the beginning of the end for Ireland rugby. For our World Cup campaign was that England game in February.
Yeah.
England missed way more tackles than Ireland that day. But they made more, and it was a new stat that almost was kind of created that weekend, dominant tackles. I don't know how they capture, exactly how they capture dominant tackles, but way more dominant tackles. But obviously, if you're trying to smash guys, you're going to miss more. But they backed each other up loads. So I think that's kind of why, you know, people get bogged down. Ooh, 30 whatever missed tackles. Good luck winning that game against New Zealand. But it's so misleading sometimes whenever defence is totally different to how it used to be.
If you look at this, man, I just took some of the stats from the game, and you consider like how well England played. If you're going to go after New Zealand, where are you going to go after them? You're going to go, okay, well, what are Northern Hemisphere teams generally good at? Is that we're going to go after their set piece. So we'll try and disrupt their line-out. You obviously have to have your own line-out functioning and your own scrum. We'll try and disrupt their line-out. We'll try and disrupt their scrum base. And after, like, that's what England did. Like, New Zealand only had 9 line-outs. They lost 2 of them, but they also had their delivery disrupted on maybe 3 of those, and they also had another one turned over. Itoje was class. Like, He was so effective in disrupting delivery, turning a ball that the New Zealanders had won into a maul turnover.
And so that would have been so. Again, just to get into like a selection or a tactical kind of decision from New Zealand's point of view, they picked Barrett obviously because they wanted to look after their line out. Surely,
yeah. Steve Hansen said that. And he was a little bit pointed towards Barrett, but I'm not sure. Like,
he's being careful. He didn't want to be a dick to him.
Well, he fucking absolutely like he.
But then he was.
He absolutely. It was like, don't take this personally.
Don't take it personally.
It was like, well, what about Scott Barrett? I said, well, you know, we wanted to win a bit more lineup ball. I don't think Sam Kane is the answer there. I don't think their lineout is that much better with Sam Kane in there.
Yeah.
And I thought Scott Barrett was the form was up there with Sevilla as their form forward. So the decision made sense to me. It's just saying if I think he didn't perform well, you know, he's going to feel pretty average. So I'm not going to say that. But, you know, if we could pick the team again, we'd probably do something different. Yeah. I was like, well, fuck.
He really dodged that one, Steve.
Yeah. Oh, Barrett's probably there going, oh, whew.
What a roller coaster of emotions.
But look, this is what I looked at, man, right? Is that they went after their set piece.
Yeah.
Okay? And they got dominance there. In terms of they edged it in the scrum, won a scrum penalty there, an exit, Vunipola on Lalala, and then they obviously messed up their line out. But then still, this is why New Zealand are so good. Look at all the stats. New Zealand had 12 clean line breaks against them. England had 6. New Zealand had 154 carries, similar to 147 from England. Uh-huh. Yet New Zealand made 639 metres versus 406 metres that England made. Uh-huh. And then the same thing, like, New Zealand had 21 offloads, England had 9. So New Zealand were still New Zealand.
I'd say 15 of those were Sonny Bill when he came on.
Yeah, but think of it, man. So how many times New Zealand got in behind them, breached them, kept making these, you know, kept testing them. And it was just this, like you said, incredible scramble defence that kept England in it. It's not enough to say, if we just mess up their set piece. That was obviously a big part of it. But they still, all the unstructured play, New Zealand were still ripping England.
Yeah.
And it's just that England's defence and England's conditioning, man, they were so fit.
Yeah.
To play like that for 80 minutes against them, it was phenomenal.
And they were getting better and better as the game went on.
That's true.
New Zealand were just dying. They were just dying. They were... They just had no idea how to, and I was taking the pit, like Sonny Bill, and just went into every contact trying to offload, trying to create a moment of magic.
Yeah, because there's scoreboard pressure on them, so they had to create. And it's funny, like, you know, you were talking about the mental side of the game. You were saying, like, James Lowe saying about how much time they spend on the mental side. At times, it looked like England were, like New Zealand were panicking a little bit. Like, you could see the players' eyes, and they were going, like, holy fuck, man, we're really struggling to break this, to break these lads down.
Yeah.
Or they're not giving up. Even though they were getting in behind them, they're not giving up. But then, like, so... And then you compare that England kicking the ball 32 times versus 24 times by New Zealand. So, like, that's, like, there's a lot of the elements of the South African game, like being strong in the set piece, having a real strong kicking game, really aggressive defence. They're all there from England. But on top of the reason that England were able to break them down is their forwards passing. Think of Sinclair playing a little tip on to Courtney Laws. Think of Sinclair popping the offload initially like there was low. That's the difference, man. The passing forwards create space.
Yeah. So and again, that was the big difference between Ireland and the All Blacks last week. We were discussing it here. Just their phase play, their tip-ons, their circle passes, out the back passes, so crisp, so sharp. And then England did exactly to them what they've been doing, what they did to us.
And it's
so the set piece. So to get that balance, England don't need to make a decision: do we go after a set piece, or do we get guys who are mobile and who can play rugby? They don't. It doesn't matter because this is the same. They go Sinclair. He's going to lock down a scrum, and he's going to be unbelievably good around the park. Itoje, he's going to compete at line out. He's going to secure our line out, and he's going to be unbelievably good around the park in attack and defence. Those two fellas were unreal. The English back row as well was class. I know they're getting all the chat, but I just, again, it's kind of changed my mind a little bit the last couple of weeks, just seeing how dominant the New Zealand front five were in phase play, and seeing that being done to them has kind of underlined how important that is.
You watched Joe Moody when he played against Ireland, how many times he was just careering onto the ball, getting in behind Irish players, looked so comfortable, looked balanced on the ball. And then you saw the same then with Mako Vunipola taking the ball as first receiver off lineouts with Billy Vunipola outside him or Manu Tuilagi outside him. You know that. You know, we have seen, we have, like, Ireland can do it.
Yeah.
It just has to be a sustained effort, and, you know, you have to persist with it, and, like, it's going to go wrong. But that's, like, England just showed, this is, like, that's, this is where England are now, is where I would have predicted that if things kept going well for Munster over the next few years, that's where Munster could go. Because they have, like, strong set piece, you know, like traditionally, like I'm just saying from when Rassi came in, we would have focused on those things: strong set piece, kicking game, aggressive D, and then like being competitive in attack. And then we started to add in layers over the years. Then Rassi and Jacques went back, and, you know, Johan came in, and he would have had some different ideas around how we do certain things, and we would add a little bit of unpredictability. But it comes down to, so much of it is down to player quality. So when you've got Joey Carberry there, who can pass the ball so well, who can, you know, that's the difference. And it's just, I think that's, everyone...
So you can get this far with all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then the top bits, the Joey Carberrys, the Itojis, the talent.
The top players. But like even that model, that Saracens, South African model, like that gets you, that will get you with players of a certain level of ability, will get you really far. Like that first year that Rassi came in, the year before, we'd barely gotten into Europe with Munster, barely scraped in. We took basically the same group of players and applied that clarity of game plan, and we won, I'd say, more games than Munster have ever won in a year. Now, we got to the final and we got ripped apart in the Pro 14 by Scarlets. They just tore us apart and we lost the Saracens. But there was, like, to show the difference, that you go from barely getting into Europe to getting to a European semi-final to get into the final of the Pro 14, you got to add layers in after that. I think that's sort of how you progress.
Yeah, so, right, slight change of tone. So that's the rugby. That's what Rassi contributes, or Eddie Jones contributes in terms of rugby.
Mm.
And those are the two teams who were kind of outstanding at the weekend. But it's the atmosphere or the environment or the excitement or the spirit within the team, kind of. There's something about the way England played. They played with smiles on their faces. They were totally expectant to win. At the end, they didn't even really celebrate that much. They were just like, right, let's get on with it. There's back slaps. There's a buzz. There's an enthusiasm. And obviously, Razzie's brought that with South Africa as well. They seem to be enjoying their rugby. Beat the All Blacks in August. They've got a spring in their step. What is it? Because I haven't had enough exposure from enough coaches to kind of know one or two different, slightly different types of approach. But I'm talking about the non-rugby approach. I'm talking about the social, the environment, the atmosphere,
the culture that they
create. Yeah. What is it? Because I'm racking my brains. So I'm trying to think. Anything like team building to me is lame. It's so lame.
Forced, isn't it?
Yeah, it's forced fun. It's artificial fun, and it doesn't. I don't think it really works. I know, like, we've gone to, with Ulster, we've gone up the country a little bit to like an outdoor activity centre, you know, with like zorbing and clay pigeon shooting, and we're just like, this is crap, you know.
Yeah,
like, why don't we just go for coffee, or, you know, go for lunch or whatever? It'd be better than this. And I remember that particular day, Jared went up and he left after half an hour because he was getting blinds fitted in his kitchen. We're all like, oh, wish I was getting blinds fitted in my kitchen. We're like, Jared, none of us want to be here. Like, fair enough. Anyway, he scarpered. And then there was another one with Joe. Again, it was just one of those kind of two-day camps after Europe they would have done occasionally. We split up into groups and it would be, you had to make this race car, and there was like a wooden base and wheels and bits of cardboard, and they were all coded, so you all had to like come together and show leadership and teamwork and all this lame stuff, you know. And I was just imagining Joe walking around with his clipboard or one of his minions, you know, someone else walking around with a clipboard and saying, oh, Trimby knew to put the wheel on the correct side of the chassis.
Steering wheel there in James Ryan's group.
Yeah. Oh, it looks like Trimby will be selected for Six Nations, I would imagine. Yeah. Do you know, and it's not even fun, actually. I was going to say it's fun. It's not even fun. It's lame, and I don't see there's any... That's what typically, you know, go go-karting or go clay pigeon shooting or you play for five-a-side
compulsory Monday. Fun.
It doesn't work, but there must be something else. The Japan side, they're playing with smiles on their faces. There's an obvious buzz in the way they're playing rugby. England, South Africa, there's an obvious buzz and they love spending time together, love playing rugby.
Mm.
And what is it? What does Razzie do, for example?
It's a good question because you're always thinking about it, because your strategy, the way you play, is always going to change based on what players you have available. If your backs are slow to move the ball, you're going to probably, you know, you're not going to focus on the run that much that week. If the conditions are terrible, you know, you might have to focus more on the kick. Your strategy will change. If the weather is dry, you're going to run a bit more. But your culture should that lives and that shouldn't change through the year. And I think good culture is good culture, regardless of whether it was 20 years ago or 15 years ago or you know, 5 years ago. And I think what Razzie came in and was very, very open and very transparent with it. Because you know what I mean? Like, the cool thing about rugby as a player is that you should feel like you're pretty much in control of your own destiny. The harder you work, the more you should get out of it, because you start working on your passing, and then later on that day you get to go out in the field and you see, oh, my passing's a little bit better. Yeah. You know, work on your conditioning, get a little bit better conditioning, work on your, you know, some aspect of your aerial game or something like that. But there has to be a transparency in that. You have to feel like that you will be allowed the opportunity to express your improvement from your work. And I think Razzie came in from the start and was very good in terms of setting out expectations for everyone. So he said, listen, all I want you to do is try and get better every single day. And when you get out for those 80 minutes to play, I want you to absolutely empty the tank. Just give me all your effort, every bit of effort that you have. And and obviously we set out the game plan. We went through that. We went through it and everyone sort of had a bit of input, you know what I mean? But Razzie positioned it. He just said, well, here's a couple of different game plans where you can play off 9, you can play off 10, you know, different advantages to this, different advantages to that, playing 2-4-2, playing 1-3-3-1, you know, all different ways of playing, and you get the advantages and disadvantages. And we kind of agreed on it as a group. We said, okay, we're going to go with this one. But Razzie had obviously prepared it so that we were all going to go with the one that he was most comfortable with.
He tricked you.
A little bit, maybe. But it was pretty common sense that this is, oh, well, obviously we're gonna start with prioritizing these bits, and then he just made the expectation. So everyone knew who came in said, as long as you just try your best, because when you're 10 years of age and you're going out to go for a run, and you're in a race or something, your mum just says, go out and do your best, Andrew. That's all you can do,
yeah.
And it's still the same. It's still the very same. Like when
I wasn't players, what my dad was saying.
No,
mum said, do your best. Dad was like, don't let me down.
okay. But like, it's still the same for the players. All of the work that they've done, when they go out in the World Cup final, you just say, listen, you don't want them tied up in their own heads feeling they can't make a mistake or that,
yeah,
you know.
It's freedom to express themselves.
Freedom to go out and
a good example
play.
Of that with Razzie, actually, is Zeebo, because he's a massive Razzie fan.
Yeah.
And it might not have been a game plan that would have suited someone like Zeebo, because it was direct, it was confrontational, it was physical, and he was a guy who kind of liked a bit of space and liked the ball in his hands. Maybe like Colby, same sort of thing.
You got to think it with Zeebs. Like, Razzie would have said this to us, would have said, like, because Rassi said, look, why does Zeebs play the game? He plays the game because he loves, like, he loves money, the attention. Right. He loves the attention. He loves the spotlight of it. And, you know, he likes being an individual. You know, that's why when he scores a try, he throws up the Z. And, you know, that's what he loves. And if you take that away from him, like, why is he doesn't want to play the game. So, like, if you tell Zeebs, listen, don't celebrate after you score. Well, that's, when he gets up in the morning, he goes, oh, I'm excited to go to training because I want to work on scoring some tries. That's his reason.
Yeah.
And you've got to, like, it. And you, the team can accommodate that.
Yeah.
But if Zeebs starts doing things that are, you know, if he's not pulling his weight at training because he's being a bit slack, then you say, well, look, Zeebs, you got to roll in with the group here. We want to facilitate you because he's an incredible talent.
Yeah, I imagine Zeebs, and if he did try and be something he wasn't, he'd be like Will Ferrell in Step Brothers at the Catalina Wine Mixer. And he's like, that truly is an interesting observation, you know, staying boring stuff again.
No,
here, you know who's got an interesting take on that, actually, on the celebrating? John O'Gibbs sat us down, and we were playing Treviso or something, and we scored, and we just went straight back, and there was no buzz, no atmosphere, nothing. No huddle, like, no celebrations. Yeah. And he said, lads, did we work hard for that try? Did we train something? Did we train hard to get in a position to score that try? Well, he's obviously just trying to start a conversation around it. And he said, listen, if we work hard and, you know, we manage to pull that off, even if it is just Treviso or whatever it is, whatever stage you score these tries, no matter how important, he says, if you put the work in and you get there and you execute something, there should be a good feeling from that. Why don't we all get in and just celebrate? High fives, hugs. Let's just enjoy a big moment, because that's why we're playing the game, to score tries.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, actually, yeah, but the other way of looking at that is with Joe, it would be poker face. Mm. And England, I think, actually probably got a bit of both. They do a bit of backslap and a bit of woo, you know, when they get turnovers. They did that in the Lions actually quite a bit.
That's Sarri's.
Oh, yeah.
So Sarri's have that, they call it like the death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
Where it's not so much, if you have to wait till you score a try to start celebrating and getting animated in front of the opposition, you could be waiting 20 minutes to score a try. Whereas if you force a turnover and the opposition are like, oh shit, they're not going to be like, oh shit, ah, shucks. But like, we see it, like when we prep, you'd see like, if a Toje forced a turnover, all the Sarri's ads would get so animated. They're like, yes!
Yeah, it's so fake. It's annoying though.
But you're almost thinking, like, what ends up happening is you start going, fuck man, this means so much to them or something like that. And what they're doing is they're trying to energise themselves off little wins all the way through. So they win a scrum penalty, they all get up and start high-fiving the back run and said, oh fuck, well done, great scrum. Yeah. You know, and then like it means that they're not waiting for that moment when they score a try. Like this, that will come. But all of the times you're just feeling like intimidated. They're getting energised off every little win they get. So the death by a thousand cuts. There's different ways of looking at it, but Rassi's thing with someone like Zeebs is just like, you have to make it, when you come in from a culture, you have to say, listen, this is the number one thing, so the team comes first. And after that, then we will accommodate everyone within that to the best of our ability. So some guys want to play rugby because they want to make a lot of money. Some guys want to play for Ireland. Some guys want to win as many trophies. Some guys want to play because they make their mum and dad proud. And all of those things can come in under the umbrella of putting the team first. And it's just as long as nothing steps beyond that. Like, so if some guys wear the wrong gear, you know what I mean? That's not a big deal. But if it irritates some of the other team or takes from their prep, then you got to say, listen, we need you all to row in here because the team comes first. And, you know, if Trimby wearing the wrong hoodie during a captain's run irritates some of the other players, well, listen, just fit in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's two ways. It's two ways of approaching it, and it seems like South Africa have gone that direction. It looks like England have kind of harnessed both the benefits of both, in that they seem like pretty poker faced, pretty relentless. They win the game, they beat New Zealand, one of the best performances we've ever seen, and they're just like, right, on to next week, pure poker faced. But then there's moments in the game where you can see the energy in the team, you can see loving playing for each other, and it was so impressive, I thought.
Well, they're just so well conditioned, and they would have been exhausted by the end of that game, because even though they were comprehensive, there was so many times when New Zealand could have ripped them apart because they're New Zealand.
Yeah.
So even though England were dominant nearly everywhere, they still still had twice as many clean breaks. New Zealand still had twice as many clean breaks. Had over nearly 250 metres more on carries. You know, like, you know, had way more offloads. There was so many times. That's why New Zealand are so hard to beat. And it was such a complete performance by England that they, even though when they were stretched, they still scrambled. And you get massive turnovers from Curry or a massive, massive hit from Underhill just suddenly stems the tide of four positive win moments from New Zealand. I think good culture is good culture, whatever way you put it. And I think what Eddie Jones has done is he's taken a team, he's prioritised all of the key mechanical things, set piece, defence, kicking game, and then he's added in, you know, like if you watch the Rising Suns, that the England, the vlog that's on YouTube, you just see every time the England players are just working on catch pass things, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
Like at the start, I was like, oh, I'm not really sure if England are they just going to be relying on power. But like the difference is that when Kyle Sinclair throws that little circle pass or pops that ball out of the tackle, that keeps the ball alive, and that means that defences don't have an opportunity to get set.
Yeah.
And that was the difference with them. I thought they were class.
Yeah, Eddie Jones is being lauded now for being an absolute genius.
Mm.
Selection wise, obviously made the change from the quarter final, put George Ford back in there.
Mm.
For me, that's not necessarily being a genius. That's just, I've got loads of class players. I can play Farrell at 10 and Slade, or I can play Ford and Farrell. Both are going to be amazing. Both are going to work well. Now, Ford had the game of his life. He was unbelievable.
I would have thought that Ford was selected on the basis that we can afford to play Ford here now, because I don't think New Zealand are going to change how they play to go after George Ford.
Whereas, Why is that the issue with Ford, that he's vulnerable?
Yeah. Like, we would have, like, look, he's one of the best passers of the ball, and he's a really, really good kicker of the ball, and he's got good movement. But I think that he's, you know, you can get momentum if you carry into his channel.
Yeah.
And I thought that's, you know, I thought maybe with Karevi when they were playing Australia, I thought that Karevi would be straight down George Ford's channel all day. And they said, oh, we're going to change it up and put Owen Farrell in there. Now, the fact is that South Africa will 100% go after George Ford if he starts.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether Eddie Jones is going to drop George Ford after the way he played. The other side is,
how could you?
Well, yeah. he, look at it like Henry Slade probably thought, like, I did enough there in the Australian game. But here's an even bigger question now is, you saw how England started that game against New Zealand, 100 miles an hour, incredibly hard to stop. And once, and they did the same to Ireland when they played in the Six Nations, didn't they?
Yeah, straight away. Yeah.
So what South Africa have done the last couple of weeks for their last two games is they've probably put the Beast, Mbanambi, Franz Malherbe, maybe Lou De Jager or Etzebeth.
Uh-huh.
They've gone with probably their bigger, heavier forwards, or maybe the guys who they would see as maybe less conditioned.
The fatties.
They've gone with those guys to start, and they've finished then with Kitchoff for his ball carry when he comes on, obviously his scrum.
Yeah.
Vincent Cock is far more mobile than Malherbe. Malcolm Marks far more mobile than Mbanambi. Franco Mustard has probably got the biggest work rate out of, along with Steph Dutoy, of all the South African forwards. So they bring them on, they take Vermeulen off, and they can bring on Francois Lowe, you know, because they're taking off these big, huge, heavy guys, and then they're really strong for the last 30 minutes. But I'm not sure if they can do that now. Can they afford?
You think they can't last? No. They can't get through that first 10 minutes whenever England comes out of the
blocks? I think that they need to start really well against England, because the thing is that what we were conscious of when you play the way South Africa play is that if you get scoreboard pressure on you, so if the opposition, that just means if the opposition go ahead,
mm-hmm.
you now have to force to play a little bit more. Like if you watch it, South Africa were pretty keen, or were pretty comfortable to not break, to not start going, we need to run the ball a little bit here. They never got bored with kicking. But if you're behind by almost two scores, you start going, oh, shit, I know that I should be kicking here, but we're gonna have to try and force this and run. So I'm not
saying it's the exact same model that Saracens do.
Yeah.
If you go behind against Saracens, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. You never come back. because then you have to start doing something that you don't do naturally, and then they start picking off intercepts or turnovers.
So it'll be really interesting to see, does Rassie go, is he going to start, is he going to start his, is what you'd imagine is his strongest team to start? Yeah. Is he going to start Vincent Cock is a difficult one, because they've got to be 100% comfortable in his scrummaging. He's definitely on the field. He's far better than Malherbe.
He's not as good in the scrum, is he not?
I'm not sure. I've always rated Vincent Cock, uh-huh. but I think he struggled a little bit at times last year. Malcolm Marks is potentially the best hooker in the world. Stephen Kitchoff, potentially one of the best loose heads in the world. He's fantastic. Mostart has an incredible work rate. So I'm not sure, like, can they afford, they need to start really well against England. Because if England get into a lead against them, and then England will know then, okay, if England get two scores ahead against South Africa will be like, how are we going to score tries? We're mm-hmm. going to score tries from our maul.
Yeah, is Colby fit?
Colby, I'd imagine, I don't know. I'd imagine he will be fit, I'd imagine.
Yeah, like it'd be touch and go, but they're hoping to get him fit, yeah.
Because, like, I watched them against Japan, and even in the last game there against Wales, like, Pollard had a couple of injections for the try, but after that, Pollard, Delende, Lucas Nyoam, and Willy LaRue specifically, they're not creating, you know? They're not creating. Even simple catch-pass stuff, like, in the Japan game, South Africa had 27% possession in the first half. 27% possession. And in that 27% possession, they had like maybe three simple catch pass that they could have scored a try off that they messed up. If you're only going to have 27% possession, you're comfortable with the opposition having the ball, well then when you do have the ball, you have to be super clinical with it. And I think that's been an area that it's been so poor for them that it's bound to come up.
Yeah. What do we feel? Have you been chatting to Felix at all about it?
I chat to him, but I'm conscious that I'm going to be talking on shows like this or on Air Sports, so I try not to ask him stuff about team. I just ask him how he's getting on. What's the mood out there? Like, you know, what's the World Cup? He's the one who said to me. I said, "Geez, I watched Scotland Samoa today." And I said, "Oh, fucking Scotland's handling was terrible." And he goes, "Fly, you've no idea." He goes, after 30 minutes, it's just so humid, it's so sweaty, it's so hard to catch the ball. So I was like, okay. So it's good to, it kind of, you're going to temper your comments a little bit more than when you're sitting in a studio watching a game.
Yeah.
I've just been asking him about how he's finding Jack and Rassie and Alad, and how he's finding working with the different players there and the different cultures, and what's he learning, and it's just been interesting chatting to him. Think of it, man. In May, Felix turned down his contract from Munster, and now he's coaching in a World Cup final.
What's he going to do when the World Cup's over?
I don't know. We'll see. I'd say if they win the World Cup, he's certainly going to have a lot of options now anyway. But
yeah.
If they win the World Cup, he's going to be the first Irishman. It's going to be interesting. Then you see if I just like. I had a lot of people asking me, like, I did the Munster Ospreys game, and everyone was there to me, "Oh, Stephen Larkham, what are we going to see from him?" And I was like, Stephen Larkham isn't, there is no silver bullet. There is no perfect thing that comes in and fixes it. It's, a lot of it is down to players and player quality. You can definitely see there's a bit more offloading coming in, but, you know, people don't seem to grasp that it's not just change the coach and all the players suddenly become amazing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's not the case. That's it.
Yeah,
it's a nice story to see, like, to be a mate of Felix's, and to see him turning down the Munster contract in May, and then, you know, to be coaching at a World Cup final. Like, it's disappointing because he's such a good coach and he's not at Munster. But
no, but it's great to see, because he's a good fella. He knows his rugby. He works hard. You obviously know him better than I do. But yeah,
Two-Face.
Yeah, he's yeah. It's nice to see someone like Felix do well.
Yeah.
Right, we'll be back with part two.
Die Harder, which then...
I think it's just telling you what's happening in the film. I don't think actually the
people are dying harder. It's like a warning. Yeah, for parents.
Yeah.
Just if your kid's watching this, you know there's going to be people dying harder, don't you? Which makes you wonder, why was Die Hard 3 not called Die Hardest?
What was that one called?
It was called With a Vengeance.
Oh yeah,
Die Hard with a Vengeance.
See, now that is what that one was called. That wasn't called Die Hard 3. That one's called Die Hard Vengeance. Yeah. Whereas Die Hard 2 is called Die Hard 2.
Fine, okay, yeah.
I think Die Hard with Vengeance is my favourite.
Yeah.
Mm.
Danny Glover?
No, Samuel L. Jackson.
Sorry. Lethal Weapon.
Yes, yeah. You were. It's my last day on the job. God. My 50, I'm too old for this shit.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome back to part two. Ireland, what's the story? Why do they not peak at World Cups, Fla? Shouldn't we just move away from focusing on the Six Nations?
This is... We obviously discussed this off camera, and it's actually a bugbear of mine is that it's one of fundamentally the stupidest questions ever, man, or stupidest kind of mindsets. Let's stop focusing on the Six Nations and start focusing on winning World Cups.
What, do we turn down opportunities to win Six Nations and then say, no, we've got a longer game in mind here?
This is the point, is that, like, Andy Farrell now is going to be the head coach coming into this. It's going to be his first Six Nations. You saw, off the back of all the goodwill that Joe Schmidt had generated over his six-year tenure, winning Grand Slams, winning championships, and then the fact that we lost two games in the last Six Nations, everyone lost their minds. They were like, what's happened to us? We've gone to shit. The World Cup is not even going to happen for us now. And I'm like, this is like, you have to just try and win everything. Win everything. The only thing that you can try and do, and you've got to try and win the Six Nations every single year.
But you should try harder at World Cups.
Yeah, actually, that's probably it.
Should you not?
It's actually so stupid, man. It's so irritating. I'm like thinking, like, do people have a brain cell in their head? Like, the only way you could kind of look at it and is that if you say you're playing Scotland in the Six Nations, and for instance, Joey Carberry's fit, and you're going, I think we should start Joey at 10 for this game here and give Johnny Sexton a break. Now, you'd probably be stronger with Johnny Sexton, but are you confident that you can still beat Scotland with Joey Carberry at 10? If you are, then that's the call to make.
We could have beat Scotland with Pat at 10.
But like, that way you're... And I think that Joe had it in his mind that he was trying to experiment a little bit and get some more game time into players. He didn't have Joey Carberry available during Six Nations. We lost two games and everyone just shit their pants. They were like, we lost England in the Six Nations. What's wrong with us? And then they went, oh, we lost to Wales. We're absolute shit. And I'm like, but you're the ones who are still, who'll turn around after we lose in the World Cup and go, we need to stop focusing on the Six Nations. Yeah. So if we lose all five Six Nations games and we do that 4 years on the bounce, we'll go to the World Cup and be like, we're ready for this one. It's just...
Yeah. Well, how long is Farrell's contract? Do you know, Pat?
Oh, actually, I don't know, yeah.
But I doubt it's 4 years.
I wouldn't say it's 4 years either, yeah.
Yeah, but he's going to be judged on winning, man.
Exactly. That's the point I'm making. If he gets off to a bad start in the Six Nations, 4 years before the next World Cup, he'll get hounded.
He just needs to win the Six Nations every year. And this shit about, like, just, you know, stop such a big focus on it.
Yeah, if you try and win every game you play and are successful and win a lot of games that you play in, it's likely that some of those wins will coincide at a World Cup, you know, rather than, no, let's keep our powder dry.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think Eddie Jones is a genius because he's peaked at the World Cup. He just has always tried to have his England team as good as possible. And they were class at the start, then they were crap for a wee while, and then they were class at the end. I mean, did he design it in such a way?
Guys,
he's like, we're gonna be class, and then we're gonna be crap for a while, and then we're gonna be class. And everybody goes, sign him up. That's how his interview went.
He just transitioned, like, he's bringing in new players, bringing in Curry and Underhill, and stop, man.
Right, come on, let's. Like, you're getting down. This is getting you.
No, it's just that point. I had to get it off my chest.
Right, well, let's go for black and white.
Right, your topic this week, as we all know. Guinness, I nearly forgot, is the perfect way to bring friends together. But this topic on black and white could tear the house apart. Mm-hmm. So, your topic this week is... I'll find it here. I've scribbled it down somewhere. We should all cheer England on in the World Cup final. Who wants to be pro-England? Who wants to be anti-England?
I'll be anti-England.
Oh, all right.
Happy enough?
So, if you're anti-England, then I'm pro-England.
You're pro-England. Yes. I think that's... It's more contentious for me to be pro-England.
Okay. you know, we are playing against Felix and Rassi and Jack and Alad, the South Africans, so that's pretty easy for you.
Yeah.
Oh, he's handed you one there. You could win this week.
I don't mind. I'm happy to be
okay,
there.
Okay, okay. The reasons we should support England.
Right, I'll go.
Have we been taping the whole time here?
This is taping the whole time. Okay. Yeah.
The reasons we have been supporting England, the reasons we should support England in the final, is because they're a Northern Hemisphere side. We're going to play against a lot of those players. And, you know, we know that Tadhg Furlong's on a level with Kyle Sinclair. We know that... I'm struggling now. James Ryan is there and thereabouts with Mauro Itoje. You know, we know that we have players who play at those who play against those guys, and they compete with them and they do well. We've seen how England have built in the set piece, kicking game, defensive, a strong defensive game, and then they've added the extra layers on top. That's something that we can do with Ireland. That's a model that we can follow. We know that Tadhg Furlong is a fantastic ball handler. We just need to get him on the ball.
Okay,
a bit
okay,
more.
Right.
Hang on a second. I'm not finished.
I'll give you 5 seconds.
I think that it would be nice to put to bed some of the 2003 World Cup heroes and get some new guys out there. That was really painful for me to say. I have to say all of that.
Yeah, that's fine. I think the last bit was reasonably convincing. Mm. Okay, so England have created a model by which you can get into a position to win a World Cup at this stage and potentially win a World Cup when we're talking next week. Mm. And so your argument is that we can replicate that because we have James Ryan and Tadhg Furlong.
Shit, my argument like that.
But I know what you mean, right? But wouldn't it be great if we did it first? They've created a bit of a platform and they said, here's how to do it. And then they get chinned by Razi and Felix and Dwayne Vermeulen at the weekend, and then stop it dead. Then we don't have to listen to English media spouting out about how good they are. We don't have to have like this generation's Lawrence Dallaglio, Johnny Wilkinson just drinking in the money from that post dinner, after dinner speeches. Why don't we say, right, that's a good idea. We're going to do that. James Ryan, Tadhg Furlong, gather round, fellas. Mm. We are going to win the World Cup in 2023.
Wow. It's pretty solid.
Yeah. It was a shot to know. I think as soon as I bagged that I was going to be anti-England, that I'd more or less won the argument.
Yeah,
straight away. Yeah.
Trivia back.
Yeah.
The losing streak is over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez, did I lose four in a row?
It was a long time. It's going to Barry Murphy.
Yeah, you know
stretch.
What though? This is World Cup year and I'm peaking at the World Cup. I lost four Six Nations
there we
in
go.
A row.
There we go. That's it.
Right. Thanks everyone for listening on all your favourite apps, and for those of you who are watching on YouTube, please do leave us a rating and a review. We promise to read out any decent ones. So we've got one from Sheridan, 1985. I suspect Sheridan was born in 1985 and has never updated his.
You don't update your age, man.
No.
Your date of birth.
So I don't know why I said that. Anyway, the review was, great pod. Makes the journey to work on a Monday easier. Also, now you two are averaging 2.5 children. Isn't it time you thought about getting the snip? Sheridan, I am campaigning to get the snip. Every day I go home, I ask Anna, please,
cut my dick off.
I hear it's painful, but not as painful as a fourth child. So I'm right with you there, Sheridan, 1985.
Anyway, next live show, we can possibly cut your dick off.
We can do a live
show.
Yeah. A live snip. Gather around, folks.
Yeah, might have to get a doctor or something like that.
Okay, cheers to everyone that was involved in making the show. Pat, Alan, Fiona and Anthony. This has been Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Party on.
Party on.
You were listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for the facts.